Let's think this through. If we ask corporate for that, then...
They are either going to say yes or no.
Could go either way. We don't know what they are going to say.
Think it through.
You have to think it through. Because if they say no...
Gotham Sports Network presents NYG Weekly.
Ethan Weiss here with you once again. Before we get into everything, you know what we got to do? We got to take care of the housekeeping. So first things first, you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow me at EthanGSN. Follow Weiss at NYG Daily. Follow the blog at GothamSN. Subscribe. We're everywhere. iTunes, Audioboom, Google Play, Stitch Radio, Spotify. Subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe. Rate us 5 stars. Leave us a kind review. We've been on a bit of a kick recently with the Giants beat. First it was Jordan, then it was Zach, and now the honorable and always correct Dan Duggan, The Athletic. Follow him on Twitter at dduggan21. Dan, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on, guys.
Always happy to have you. Dan, you are probably... No, we don't play favorites here. We love all the Giants beat writers in their own respective manner. But what I love about your writing, and for those who haven't, go subscribe to The Athletic. Really, really good journalism all around, not just for the Giants, but for your favorite team all across the country. There's really no holds barred with you. You tell it how it is, and you back it up with the numbers. I see a lot of writers whom I'm not going to name right now that like to – and we may or may not be having these writers on the podcast in the near future as Weiss is smirking into the camera. We'll see if that happens in the next few weeks. But, Dan, the way that you write really just – it puts everything together very nicely, both statistically – and from an organizational direction perspective. We're going to get into the game. We're going to talk about the direction of the franchise. Weiss, where do you want to start, and how can we pick Dan's brain to the benefit of our listeners first?
Well, I think let's start with the Cleveland game.
Sure.
Right? Because it sort of segues to the bigger picture here. The game last Sunday was just a reminder to me that while there have been some strides made by this franchise, I believe, there's still a lot of work that needs to happen. There's still a lot of house cleaning that needs to take place. And I believe that while the head coach, fingers crossed, is the right one for the job, I think the organization still has a lot of work to do to get to where Cleveland is right now. And I just think Sunday's game, they were outclassed top to bottom, I think, from offense, defense. I mean, Cleveland had their way. And I know the Giants were dealing with a boatload of injuries, including with their quarterback. But it was just a continuation from what we saw against Arizona. Giants are not there yet. They might be closer than when they were in the past. But, you know, it's just a reminder where we are. Still a lot of work to do. But what do you think, Dan? Is it sort of like – I look at it from that sense, but what do you think about
– I just want to say – I'll say one thing real quick to sort of lead Dan into it a little bit. But the big missing piece for the Giants on Sunday night was the absence of James Bradberry. And – We've taken a look at the numbers. Dan, you've written about it, but the Giants' defense did not run any more or less zone than they did in the past. And without James Bradberry, Baker Mayfield sat there all day long, picked apart the Giants' defense, and that just one missing piece crumbled the entire defense. And just to reiterate what Weiss said, just goes to show that they are more than just one piece away. They're missing pieces everywhere. What were your thoughts on the game as a whole and what it says about the Giants and what they need to do moving forward as an organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sums it up pretty well in terms of that. The one missing piece, that can't be enough to make your team crumble. I think the 4-game winning streak was legitimate. I'm not one of these people who says, oh, you beat a backup quarterback or bad teams. Like, you know, you gotta beat bad teams, you gotta beat good teams, whatever.
Yeah, they beat the Seahawks, Seattle, yeah.
Right, and so once they beat Seattle – you said, like, okay, like, they're actually building something. And then I know they've had the quarterback injuries, but these last 2 weeks have felt like, you know, sort of a sobering blow. They kind of crashed back to earth, whatever cliche you want to use. And it just reminded you that, you know, a four-game winning streak doesn't mean that they've patched up all these holes. These holes are still very much there. And it's really not even just about Bradbury. It's about the pass rush. I mean, my goodness, Mayfield sat back there and no one breathed on the whole game. So you add those two elements together, no pass rush, and you got a, you know, converted safety playing corner. And Isaac Yiadom, God bless Patrick Graham and Jerome Henderson, whoever coached him up. But, I mean, he's not a legitimate NFL number two corner. He's played like one for stretches this year. But, I mean, again, when teams go at him, they tend to expose him. So there's still glaring weaknesses and important spots, too. It's not like, hey, they just need to find a right guard and the O-line will be clicking. It's cornerback, edge rusher, number one receiver. Like, these are premium positions. And for a team that has had the sort of premium assets that invested elsewhere, that's what it always comes back to when we start talking these big picture thoughts with Gettleman, like, you know, loading up on defensive tackles. We obviously know about the running back with the most valuable asset they've had. You know, all of those types of things, whether or not those players are good, it takes away where you can invest elsewhere. And then you end up with Isaac Yiadom as your number two corner. You end up with, I mean, geez, Jabal Sheard and Carter Coughlin as your edge rushers in a must-win game late in the season. I mean, I know there's injuries there, but at the end of the day, you know, Lorenzo Carter and O'Shane Zimenez should be your backups to some stud edge rusher instead of those being the guys you rely on. They get hurt, and then you're stuck playing guys off the street. So, yeah, I mean, listen, I've obviously been a pretty staunch critic of Gettleman throughout his tenure.
Welcome.
But to your very glowing intro, I try to be fair. And, you know, I really break his tenure down into, you know, three off seasons. I give his 2018 off season an F. Like, it was everything he did there was wrong and didn't work and set things back. I thought his 2019 off season was probably a C. Like, he finally started to actually, you know, do moves to get the rebuild going. Whatever you thought about the Odell trade, that was at least a move that got draft picks and got, you know, cost efficient players and Peppers in here. The draft was, you know, obviously it's going to hinge on Jones, but he acquired draft capital. And then this past offseason, you know, felt like an A. You know, and people want to say, oh, it's like Judge's influence. Like, who cares? Like, I've always said that. Like, as long as they get along, which is going to be the biggest probably ingredient of what happens going forward, if they get along, who cares if it's Judge's influence? I mean, you know what I mean? Get them themselves to go and find the guys. Or, I mean, you know, Judge isn't grinding film on, you know, every undrafted free agent. So if they're working in concert and the results are good, I'm not considering discredit Gettleman. You know what I mean? I think he's clearly always let his coaches have a lot of say. You just look at all the Arizona Cardinals that came in or guys that had ties to Pat Shermer. I mean, he's always let his coaches have influence. So if it works with Judge, that's great. But again, so you're talking three off seasons and it probably levels out to a C or probably lower I'm not trying to be too fair here. I mean, that 2018 off season really put him in a deep hole that they're still kind of climbing out from. It's like the rebuild didn't even start until year three or year one and a half, whatever you want to say. And that's why I made a comparison after the game. My game story was like them and the Cleveland Browns had the 1-2 pick in the 2018 draft. So they were starting essentially at the same place, and look at where they both are right now, 3 years later. So, you know, people try to poke holes in that. Like, granted, they got Myles Garrett the year before. They also went 0-16. So it's not like they had this huge core of talent that was just waiting to bubble over.
And it's not like the Giants are. It's not like the Giants are one pass rusher away anyway.
Right, yeah. Right. And you just look at the way Cleveland's constructed their team. I mean, they acquired them this offseason. It's been a building process, but you have to add a few pieces at a time. You can't do it all in 1 year. And it feels like that's sort of what they might have done this past offseason. And we saw in 2016 that doesn't always work. Not saying I think James Bradbury and Blake Martinez are going to turn into, you know, Janoris Jenkins and OV or anything, but. Let's see a little more sustainability, because this year there's been some promise, but again, as this long answer started, they kind of came crashing back to reality anyways, in these last 2 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's pretty simple. Like with Gettleman, I think you have to look at the body of work as a whole. A lot of people want to give him sort of a clean slate after Pat Shermer was fired, but I don't think that's fair. In 3 years, I think as a fan of this team, is it fair to say, hey, can I expect you to win, like build a 7-win roster by year three? Like, how many years is it going to take for, like, what, we're going to give them 4 years to build an 8-8 team? Like, that's just, we're seeing it in the NFL. And you brought up an excellent point. You look at the 2018 draft, one Cleveland, two the Giants, but not just that. look at all the other organizations that were picking in the top 10 and where they are now. You talked about Cleveland. Look at the Indianapolis Colts. Look at the Arizona Cardinals.
Buffalo
Bills. And it's not like these teams, you know, didn't face roadblocks along the way. For Indianapolis, Andrew Luck retired before the season started. Cleveland fired a GM, fired two head coaches along the way to get to where they are now. So all these teams face different set of obstacles that they were able to overcome and still be in a better position. And that's where I look at it and say, it's just not good enough, you know, for this being the third year. And I spoke about this a couple weeks ago when it was clear the NFC East could be won by a 6 or a 7 or 8 win team. I said, to me, you know, this is year three of Dave Gettleman. You have your quarterback. I don't think it's out of the realm to say, hey, Daniel Jones, given the state of the NFC East and what's happening with the Eagles and what's happening with Washington and how they're starting three different quarterbacks and Dallas, who lost Dak Prescott, I don't think it was, you know, something that's impossible for me to ask Daniel Jones, hey, you're the number 6 overall pick. How about you lead us to a couple of victories and let us get to 7 wins or 8 wins and win the NFC East? And if you're not able to do that, I think it's fair for me as a fan or anybody else to question whether or not, hey, is this GM the right person for the job, or is this quarterback, you know, the right, you know, option for this team? So I just look at it and say there's not enough progress there. I know that this past offseason we can give him an A and we can say he did a good job, but to me it's not enough, especially given everything that's happened in the NFCs, this division, in this season, given where they are in terms of, hey, you had a chance to really make a late push, get into the playoffs, and they were not able to do that. And a lot of it is because of how they still lack talent in key areas. And at some point, you have to just look at it and say, look, it's just the results are not good enough for us to give you a fourth year. I mean, 14-32 under Dave Gettleman. You can't think of any other GMs that could have that record but still get a fourth year with the job. That's just my opinion on it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I don't want to give away all the stuff I'm probably planning to write in the next week and a half on The Athletic, so make sure people still subscribe. but a point I think is funny, because Daniel Jones is sort of like where everything pivots on your view of Dave Gettleman. If you think he's a franchise quarterback, you say, hey, he got us a franchise quarterback. If you think he's a bust, you say, well, like, what's the point of bringing Dave Gettleman back? He whiffed on his biggest pick. And I think the problem is, you know, we're ending the second season, and we don't have a clear answer. I know, you know, people have stronger views one way or the other, for sure. But, like, he's not Jamarcus Russell, and he's not Patrick Mahomes. He's obviously somewhere in that vast middle ground, and you'd like to obviously have a little more conviction. But the funny thing is, a lot of times the excuse you hear, and this is from a Gettleman defender, is the talent around him isn't good enough.
Well, like, whose fault is that?
There you go. That's the point that's kind of like the checkmate on that argument. It's like, so either Daniel Jones isn't good enough, which that's obviously a direct blow on Gettleman. But if the problem is, well, his receivers aren't that good, his O-line's not that good, his, you know, obviously his running back's hurt, but the running game isn't good enough, which obviously I don't even think you make that case this season anyways, even without Saquon. But if the argument and his weapons and his line isn't good enough, then again, the finger still points the same person. So it's a results-oriented business. So whether it's Daniel Jones holding the offense back or the offense holding Daniel Jones back, at the end of the day, the guy responsible for putting that all together is the same person. And again, the results just have not been there. So I just find it hard to defend him on that grounds of where this offense is. I mean, it's, you know, what the only offense is better than is the Jets. I mean, that tells you the kind of company they're keeping. It's and you've used 3 premium draft picks on offensive players in those 3 drafts. So it's just kind of tough to see that this is where they're at results-wise.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you, great point. Offensively, they have invested a lot of capital into their offense. High pick on a quarterback, high pick on a skill position player, high pick on a tackle. You're averaging only 17 points a game. And you brought up an excellent point about Daniel Jones. There's more questions than answers with him. But the one thing we can answer definitively, and I think everyone should agree on across the board, regardless what your opinion on Dave Gettleman is or not, is that from year 1 to year 2, Daniel Jones has not gotten better. And a legitimate argument can be made that he's gotten worse. And I think a lot of the reason why, you know, a big reason why Dave Gettleman got that extra year and Pat Shurmur didn't, was because Daniel Jones looked so promising in his rookie season. But now it's like the quarterback has not gotten better. The roster has not gotten better in terms from a win-loss perspective. I think, you know, they finished 4-12 last year. They're going to 5-11 the year before. I think they're probably going to finish either six wins. It's just not good enough. And I think across the board, if you ask all the questions, it comes down to the fact that, hey, you got to let Dave Gettleman go, and you got to bring in somebody else in here, because there's not enough progress made after 3 years to say, hey, I'm headed in the right direction enough to give this guy another offseason.
Dan, what is your take on that, I guess? I mean, over the last 3 or 4 weeks, I feel like, I don't know if it's legitimate sources or if it's more so just opinions on what's going on, but I mean, we've heard everything from he's definitely safe to he is more than likely safe to, well, we got to see how the next 2 weeks goes, and assuming the Giants lose out, which is a very real possibility, he's gone. What is your read on the situation?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that anyone can have like a source report really at this time, because I think the Giants do a very good job of playing their cards close to the vest. Like, you know, John Mara is not like whispering in any reporter's ear what he's going to do after the season. It's just not really his style. And, you know, I do think they generally you know, let things play out. So, like, I don't think they're going to, when they're 0-5, 1-7, I don't think he's, like, ready to fire him and run down there. And they win 4 in a row. I don't think he's ready to give him a 5-year extension. I think he said here that I want to see progress. I want to see all that. I think he generally, you know, lets things. And then, you know, they obviously, I'm sure him and Steve Tisch are having conversations. But I don't think those, you know, at least in, you know, there have been a few firings on my time in the beat. And I've never really found that anything was too solid reported before it actually, you know, kind of came to fruition. That's just not how they operate. So, you know, whether they're going to keep Gettleman or not, I don't think anybody outside the organization can know. I think there's tea leaf readings and certainly, you know, you hear things that might lead you to believe one way or the other. I mean, listen, if they win the next two games, finish 7-9 and win the NFC East, I definitely think he'd be back. If they lose the next game and go 5-11, it becomes a much harder sell. And, you know, obviously, like, somewhere in the middle there, it's 6-10, and, you know, maybe I don't lose a tiebreaker or something. I don't know. I don't know that it's that granular in terms of the evaluation. I think the other part, though, you have to keep in mind is Dave Gettleman, 69, 70 years old. I mean, he doesn't plan to do this job for 20 more years. I think probably the most likely exit strategy, whether it's this year or at some point down the road, is they're not going to fire him. But they're going to say, Dave, you know, how about you go into the Ernie Accorsi type consultant role, and, you know, we'll kind of usher you off to the side and put someone else in, you know, sort of the captain's chair. I think that's the way it eventually ends. I don't know for a fact that it happens, you know, January 4th. My leaning is that it does. I just don't know how they can bring him back if it's another – see your reaction there, Wes. I don't know that they can bring him back if it's a, you know, 5-11, 6-10 season. But I do think the big unknown is, you know, what is his relationship really like with Joe Judge behind the scenes? I don't know anything definitively on that front. I never heard of any issues, put it that way. It's like, no news is probably good news on that front. Like, it didn't seem like there was some power struggle when Judge came in. I think Gettleman gave him, a lot of influence on the roster. I can't imagine why Judge would have any issues with that, but he might just say, well, listen, I want somebody else who's more aligned with my viewpoints, or someone who I have a, you know, longer background with, whatever it may be. That could certainly be the case, but I don't feel like it's a Gase McCagney thing where it's like Game of Thrones and he's, you know, some day on the door trying to kick him out. But yeah, so if you ask me right now today, I think he's probably not going to be back, but that's not based on like any sources. That's really just kind of my gut.
Like, yeah.
At this time last year, and not to like say, oh, I got my gut right, like give me a pat on the back, but I figured that's how a player Shermer would go, Gettleman would stay. But again, at that point, it wasn't based on sources either. It was just, so I'm going with the same feeling. We'll see if it's right 2 years in a row. But that's sort of how I see it playing out.
So this is sort of a two-part question. I promise I'm going somewhere with this. But related but not related, we saw totally different style of play calling from Freddie Kitchens as he took over with Jason Garrett on the COVID list, so to speak. When you look at that and you look at Colt McCoy at quarterback, Freddie Kitchens being a bit more aggressive. And I'm not talking about the fourth down decisions. Obviously, that's going to fall on Joe Judge. But just in terms of throwing downfield more. Do you think, and this is obviously just going to be speculation because no one knows for certain, is that Joe Judge and Jason Garrett conservatism in the play calling, I don't even want to say early in the season because we saw it in the middle of the season as well. In your opinion, is that more an indictment on Jason Garrett being Jason Garrett? Or is that, because I would find it hard to believe that Joe Judge and Jason Garrett would be not on the same page when it comes to being aggressive, not being aggressive. Is that more Jason Garrett being Jason Garrett? Or is that Joe Judge and Jason Garrett going, we don't really want Dan Jones sitting back there all day and airing it out?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely more of the latter. I mean, I think we've seen that if Joe Judge has a problem with one of his assistants, he's not afraid to make a change and do something about it. So if Jason Garrett was, you know, going rogue and saying, no, we're going to just run, you know, stick routes all day, that Joe Judge would, you know, be powerless to stop that. So, no, I think that very clearly Joe Judge, who is very big on saying, you know, you got to play to your roster strengths, I think he feels like a conservative offensive approach is their best chance to stay in games, to, you know, obviously pull out some games. He does not feel like, you know, airing it out is the best course of action. I've kind of said, you know, and maybe this is, you know, an NFL coach can't think this way, I'd rather just see Daniel Jones air it out. And if he throws 30 picks, you know, okay, this guy, you know,
right,
he threw 30 picks, he can't play. Or if he threw for, you know, 30 touchdowns, you say, oh boy, we got something there. This kind of like just survive every game and, you know, maybe score a touchdown. Like that just to me is like, he's a sixth pick in the draft. I want more than, you know, what Colt McCoy's ceiling is. So I don't, you know, I don't really fully agree with the way they've handled the offense and Jones in particular this season. I do understand it. You know, again, it's maybe it's a little contradictory, but like, I get why they've probably adapted it that way. But I will say, like, I know Garrett is like the absolute whipping boy and, you know, across the fan base and deservedly so early in the season. I thought early in the season, it was terrible. It was just all, you know, everyone running his version of four verticals was like guys running 6-yard curls. But I think he like hit his stride a little bit there. And I don't think Jones, you know, held up his end of the bargain all the time either. Cause if you think of that Tampa Bay game, there were guys open deep. They were calling the shots. Jones was pulling the trigger and he just wasn't connecting. And then obviously he had the terrible picks on just bad decisions, but he had three or four deep balls that he just didn't connect on that if he hits, you're saying, wow, Jason Garrett was so aggressive. And then I think they dialed it back with, I think the next week was Washington and Philly kind of managed the game. But I think there have been some shots. Like, I don't know that Colt McCoy, throwing the ball downfield, you know, a bit more, especially early against the Browns with some like drastic change where Freddie Kitchens is in his ear saying like, we're going to run the deep play. I think that you have to, you know, factor in that it's a different quarterback. So maybe Colt McCoy just, you know, he's more experienced. He sees something differently. The, you know, it's such a small sample size. The coverage is maybe, you know, there was one where he hit Slayton and it looked like Cleveland just, you know, botched that coverage. So I don't know that that was like a concerted effort. It was like Colt McCoy dropped back, saw Slayton's open through it. You know, I can't say that Daniel Jones wouldn't have done it. I can't say Jason Garrett, you know, they had that plays in the playbook. You know, Freddie Kitchens didn't put it in, you know, behind Jason Garrett's back. So it's like a layered issue. I mean, listen, I think that they probably should make a change only because Jason Garrett's offense at its best isn't that inspiring. You know, even that, you know, when they were winning games, it wasn't like, oh, wow, they've really, you know, lighting it up. But I just think he's got a little bit of a tough sell because he is limited, I think, personnel-wise, and they're trying to do what they can to win games. And then when they have called shots, the quarterback doesn't make the play or the receiver doesn't, you know, get open, whatever it may be, because they got killed for that 3rd-and-1 pass against Arizona where they took a shot. So it's like you kind of can't have it both ways. You know, they're never aggressive. Then, hey, why didn't they just run it on 3rd-and-1? You know, and I think that's why it's easy to be a media member or a fan because you have that benefit of seeing what happened before determining if it was a good decision or not.
So that, yeah, I mean, that was part one of my question, but you sort of just answered it, right? Where if they're being so conservative with Jones, Joe Judge is going to be not going to be quiet if he disagrees with one of his assistants or one of his coordinators. And you hear the comments that, oh, I love Baker. He's a gamer. I love that fire that, you know, it seems like Joe Judge has got a type when it comes to player or quarterback. I mean, look at Tom Brady in New England. To me, and I know that operating with logic is not something that you should do when discussing the Giants and John Mara. Logically, it seems pretty obvious that Joe Judge is not a huge fan of Daniel Jones. And furthermore, if they were to bring in a new general manager, Joe Judge was not here when Daniel Jones was selected. The new general manager, knock on wood, assuming I'm praying to God that it's not Kevin Abrams, the new general manager is not going to be someone who was here when Daniel Jones was drafted. The general consensus among every big insider that you hear is that, you know, the Giants reached on Daniel Jones and a bunch of people weren't particularly high on him. He has been underwhelming. And the Giants are going to have a top 10 pick in this draft in what I consider a very strong quarterback class. What do you, and people say, oh, they're not going to take a quarterback. Well, they're not going to take a quarterback if John Mara is meddling and he doesn't let Joe Judge and whoever the new GM is have his way. Do you think that there is a realistic possibility, based on everything that we just spoke about, that the Giants decide to move on from Daniel Jones?
I mean, can't rule it out. I will say I don't agree with you, though, that I think Joe Judge genuinely does like Daniel Jones. I don't know. The way he's talked about him, I don't know.
What is he going to say, though?
Well, exactly. I don't know what the coach speak, but
that's why actions speak louder than words. It's like, all right, you're not letting the guy take shots downfield. He's still got the fumble problem. And if you're on the same page as your offensive coordinator and you're being real conservative for most of the season, to me, that says everything.
That's a fair point. But the one comment that Judge made way back in the season, like week three or week four, was about how, like, when you have a young quarterback, it's about the supporting cast around him. And I had these visions because I'm from Boston, and watching Tom Brady early in his career compared to the guy he became, like those first couple of Super Bowl years, he was a game manager. It was like, don't lose the game. We have really good defense. You know, he'll make some clutch plays, but he was not airing it out. It was, you know, not until like really Randy Moss and that group came in before he became, you know, the guy we all think of now. And it just feels like it's pretty clear that, you know, Judge like knelt at the altar of Belichick and absorbed a lot of his, you know, roster building and team building, all those philosophies. So you could easily see Belichick, you know, like maybe assessing this roster. I don't know how hands-on he is, but just saying, like, listen, you're going in there, you have a young quarterback, you do this approach, do this really conservative approach, build up your defense, and let him grow into it. Now, again, I don't know. We're all projecting here because we've seen Joe Judge for one offseason. Certainly wasn't going to make a change. We'll learn a lot about how he feels about Daniel Jones, to your point of actions, you know, speaking louder than words, by what they actually do. But, no, I do say I don't think, again, he's not going to come up there and slight his starting quarterback, but it doesn't feel disingenuous, and I feel like Joe Judge, especially for being a Belichick guy, is more honest or straightforward than I would have expected when he speaks to the press. You know, I think he has said a lot of really strong comments that to me indicates he thinks Jones is really tough. The thing about Jones is his public image is really bad. Like he's so dry and vanilla and like shows no personality, but everyone you talk to who knows him in the locker room or, you know, on the field says he's a fiery guy. He's a good leader. He's like a really tough guy. Obviously the injuries are, you know, a tough break, but it's not really a lack of toughness there, maybe some durability questions. He just doesn't show that. I think he just doesn't like really doing the media and just doesn't, you know, put any effort into it. But I do think he's a respected guy, and I think he is kind of Joe Judge's type of guy. Now listen, they might have the eighth pick, and there's, you know, we're watching Zach Wilson here as we record this. He might just say, well, this guy's better, and like, you know, especially like I said, if there's a new GM and Mara's not gonna just like, you know, pound the table and say, no, we're sticking with, you know, my guy here. But I don't get the vibe that Judge doesn't like Jones, but you do, you know, your point that I kind of made as well, is they have kind of played this offense very conservatively. I can totally see that, you know, not being exactly a full vote of confidence, but I do wonder, I go back to that comment early in the year, have to, you know, dig it up for the exact wording, but it was just the general view was, you know, like when you have a young quarterback, they don't always look the same when they're, you know, the supporting cast around them is building, and then when you build the supporting cast, like, you know, then they really blossom. I mean, that applies to guys, and, you know, Ben Roethlisberger, his early years, they were winning in spite of him. And so I think that's definitely could be a philosophy Joe Judge has. So if he sees that Jones has the potential to grow into something, he might say, well, listen, we're gonna, you know, keep the handcuffs on him early in his career, and as he develops, as the team develops, we'll unshackle him. We'll see if that's how it plays out.
Speaking of Joe Judge, and I want to go back to Sunday's game, what did you think about him going for it on fourth down twice? I personally thought it was the right decision both times. It didn't work, but look, they were without James Bradbury against a team that dropped 42 a week ago against Baltimore. You have to try to get – you. Like you said, it's pretty simple. You got to score touchdowns to beat this team. Field goals were not going to cut it. Did you have – like – what are your thoughts on that? Like, was that the right decision, or was it, hey, I get you want to go for it, but is there a better play than throwing it to your center?
He should have thrown it to the kicker.
Well, we can't sit here and ask Riley Dixon to go through reads, you know, but yeah. I see.
Is Riley Dixon a bust at quarterback?
Well, that's my favorite part. Any argument that starts with, well, he should have found the kicker, like, you just lost me there. Like, the punter should have thrown to the kicker. Like, what's he thinking? No, I loved it. If anything, probably the biggest thing I've been critical on Joe Judge has been his conservative nature. And I'm not really talking about, like, the overall offensive conservative nature. I'm talking more like game management stuff, where I feel like too often it's 4th and 3 at the 41 and he calls for a punt and they pick up like 19 net yards. So, like, that's the biggest thing I've sort of had an issue with him, because I think he's really good at game management, game planning, all that stuff. But I think sometimes he definitely errs too much. I think a lot of it has to do with his special teams background, where he thinks, oh, we're going to play the field position battle and we're going to pin him back here in a punt. Like, he gets really juiced up for that. Whereas a guy like, you know, some offensive mind, like, is going to say, screw it, we're just going for it because I trust my play here. I think he looks at it more like the field position battle, because that's what he lived every day for 8 years. But no, I had no problem with that at all. I mean, listen, the fake field goal, it's easy to say after the fact, you know, why not just leave the offense out there? Well, like, it's a fake. It's supposed to catch them off guard. It's like, that's the whole point. It did not work.
And it did. And again, it did. He could have, well, Riley Dixon could have walked in. He could have hit a wide open Graham Gano. Evan Engram was open. I understand that the punter is going to be like a little frazzled in a real yeah, game situation, but it was a well-planned, poorly executed decision.
Right. But so fair. So, like, but I will say, like, yeah, you run that practice. You play it probably 6 times in practice. They don't run these plays as much as we all think they do. It's not like a high school practice where you're out there for like 3 hours. And so, like, every time they ran it, Riley Dixon, I'm sure, threw it to Nick Gates. Nick Gates caught it. Everyone thought it was fun. He spiked the ball. And that was that. It's going to work. And then Cleveland, to their credit, they just weren't fooled. Because, I mean, you know, I'm in the press box. Like, what the hell is going on? You basically look down on a, you know, 28 yard field goal, whatever it would have been. I'm not even barely paying attention. Like, why are guys running like, you know, crazy like this? But listen, that he said it after the game. Yeah, you miss, everyone second guesses it, you hit it, you're like this guru. I mean, like, fakes look weird, and if they work, wow, what a crazy, brilliant design. And when they don't, you get killed for it. But I agree with his overall sentiment. I mean, I have no problem with running the ball with Wayne Gallman on, you know, 4th and 2, but it felt like a long one. And he got tripped up. I mean, what are you going to do? Like, they've been able to run the ball pretty well all season. They ran the ball fairly well the other night. Yeah, they were not going to win that game kicking field goals. And I think it's crazy. You know, again, when I'm like watching the game, I don't read my mentions. I catch up on sort of what other people are tweeting, but I was shocked to kind of find that there was so much criticism of that aggressive, you know, mindset when I went back the next morning, which is kind of going through my mentions and just reading other stuff, because like they scored six other points the rest of the game. So it's not like the offense was really fine. Like, he knew it was going to be, you know, limited scoring with your backup quarterback. You got to maximize any opportunity you get in the red zone. He didn't think they were going to be living down there all night. And he also knew that their defense was so limited. I mean, I know they only scored 20 points, but they went up and down the field pretty much at will. And then, you know, they just, you know, took the air out of the ball in the second half because they had a big lead. But, it, you know, Baker Mayfield completed 84% of his passes. It's not as if the defense was shutting them down. So I think it was the right approach. It didn't work out. I don't think if they played it straight up and kicked field goals, it was going to work out either. So I'd rather go down swinging. And that's just sort of my, you know, whole approach if I was, you know, yeah, the guy in his seat.
And the crazy part is, like, people just don't understand. There's no guarantee that the Giants even have an opportunity for that second field goal if they don't go for it on fourth right down the first time. Because the field position, you're giving it to the Cleveland on probably the 25. You know, maybe they bring it out. Maybe they get more. Maybe they get less. They're starting from the 25. There's no guarantee that you even get that second opportunity.
Right. Yeah, no, that gets lost all the time. Because the second time, you know, they went on a 95-yard drive. So that's like the worst yeah case, that the team has to go 95 yards to make you pay for that. So, I think we all, just based on you guys' Twitter, like, lean more towards that new age, like, go for it and don't play ultra-conservatively. But, yeah, that there's so much old-school thought that, like, people can't get out of their head. Like, how often does a team go for it on 4th and goal from the 1, get stopped, and then something good still happens? A safety, or the other team punts it, and you're right back at the 40-yard line in the blink of an eye. Like, so much, you know, turnover, whatever it may be. Like, people only look at the binary result. Like, you didn't get it. It failed. But, like, the game still goes on, and they're still in a terrible position. You know, like, they're backed up. There's a million different things that can happen. Yes, I don't think people take that into account. Yeah, nearly as much as they should.
And just one other, like, so to one of the points you just made, the old school versus the new school, and this is just a mini rant and it's been bothering me all week, just in general, not just how certain teams are calling games. There are teams in the NFL that are successful every year or have become successful very quickly. And the beauty of that is you can observe those franchises and you can say, okay, well, who did they bring in? What type of offense are they running? Are they bringing in 70-year-olds to be the GM, or are they going a bit younger and a bit more innovative? What type of quarterback are they working with? What type of defense, right? All of this stuff is just public information. You can just go, okay, and you're not going to obviously be able to just blueprint your team exactly like the Kansas City Chiefs, but you go, okay, who's in their personnel department? What did they see in Patrick Mahomes that the rest of the league didn't see? What did they see in Tyreek Hill? What makes them successful? Let's try to duplicate that. And you have personnel guys, you have general managers who just look at that and go, no thanks. I'm going to do it the old school way. And it just blows my mind. Like, the blueprint is right in front of you. The blueprint for how to build a successful NFL team in 2 to 3 seasons in the modern day NFL is just there. And the number of teams that have been able to do it and go from complete dog shit to relevancy and making playoff pushes, like, we just listed all of them at the beginning of the podcast. It's just insane to me that fans of the Giants can look at what the Giants are doing versus what the Dolphins did and the Bills did and the Browns did and be like, no. I'm going to support Dave Gettleman and what he's doing for seemingly no reason. I know there's like really like no question or comment based off of that, but it boggles my mind that like it's there. The model has been, it's been calculated. It has been publicly available, and there are just teams that actively ignore how to build successful NFL franchises in 2020. It blows my mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah. All right. So Dan, I know we don't want
to ask Dan one question.
Sure.
I'll ask Dan one question. We'll get to questions. Dan, I ask this to every beat writer we have on. I'm fairly confident the Giants have found their head coach. And if you disagree, please be honest with me. Have the Giants found their long-term solution in regards to head coach? Like, is this the right guy for the Giants? Or am I just being overly confident?
No, I mean, I think so. I think there's been promising signs. I mean, listen, at the end of the day, like anything else, it's results business if they don't get the right quarterback. But I will say this. I think he's been impressive, like in terms of how he's trying to run this program. I mean, has there been hiccups playing Daniel Jones against Arizona? He didn't like the way he managed the game against the Browns. I mean, these are things every coach is going to have, blips like that along the way. But I think the overall way he's come in and just, taking this whole thing by the horns, I mean, it's so much different than what you saw from Ben McAdoo and Pat Shermer. I think you hire a 38-year-old first-time head coach who was, a special teams coordinator, John Marisetta, from the outset. They're going to be patient with him too. So he's going to get to live through some growing pains. It's not going to be a situation where if Daniel Jones has a terrible third season, they're going to fire Joe Judge after it. Like, he's going to get 3-4 years, I would think, minimum. So he's going to get a chance to grow. I think it's very clear that he has a vision for what he wants to build, the pieces they brought in this offseason and the way they've incorporated them. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to sit here at 5-9 and say, oh, yeah, they absolutely got their guy. But if I'm going just by kind of, we talked a little earlier, like gut and feel, I definitely think he has the DNA to be a successful head coach. But listen, there's plenty of guys who have, obviously everyone points to Belichick, who, the situation might not be right. Pete Carroll, when he's in New England, there's guys who go on to success at stop number two. So I'm not saying that's going to happen either. I'm just saying I think he has the DNA of a good head coach. Can't promise that means there's going to be just Lombardi trophies overflowing at the team facility. But I think, especially compared to his predecessors, they're in much better shape.
That's all music right to my ears.
Yeah. All right. Should we get to questions so that we can get Dan out of here?
Yes.
All right. From Nick, what have the Giants neglected more post Super Bowl, defensive line or offensive line?
Well, I mean, if you're talking defensive line, including edge rushers, maybe it's a debate, but if you're talking they've certainly invested quite a bit in defensive line. Especially that's the one area Gettleman has not left. That cupboard's not bare at all. I mean, they've really thrown a lot there. I mean, but it's funny, even offensive line, it's sort of one of the big criticisms Jerry Reese got. He invested in it, not
exactly
as well as he should have.
Exactly.
He just didn't, maximize those picks. But I mean, there was first round picks used there. There was second round picks. There was free agent signings. They just weren't, Sean O'Hara and Chris Snee. They didn't, pick up the baton from those guys. But I think the idea that he neglected it, he certainly could have spent more draft capital, probably in that end of that Cruz era, and had them better positioned. But like when it got, when things got dire, he threw a lot at it. They weren't the right guys, and they didn't, you know, fulfill what they were supposed to do as a first round pick or a second round picks. But I think the answer is still has to be offensive line, because I mean, they have quality defensive line players that they've brought in since last Super Bowl. There's not a ton of, you know, quality offensive line you can say they've really even brought in since last Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with Dan spot on. I mean, but the one thing is edge rusher, the last pass rusher that they took in the first round was JPP. And
yeah,
in regards to the offensive line, I mean, you talked about the investments, Pugh, Richburg, Flowers. Remember they paid Jeff Schwartz all that money. So Reese definitely tried. It just unfortunately didn't work out. But I will say, I do hope he does get a second chance at being a GM in the NFL. I think he does deserve it. He does have the resume for it.
Yeah, I think you and I are like the only two people on Twitter on that are dying on that hill.
Count me in. Okay. He deserves it.
And the funny part is like, you know, a lot of times I think people accuse like media members of like covering for sources. Like, I mean, Jerry Reese and I had zero relationship. He was not a media friendly guy at all. And I killed him when he was here. Like he put this, and I think it's always funny where like you can, you know, kind of hold two thoughts at once about somebody. Like he deserved to get fired, but his resume is still pretty good. Like he worn out his welcome. It was time for a change here. But like, you're not going to find too many GM candidates out there with two Super Bowl rings on their hand. So
and
like,
not only that, like the guy had an eye for star talent. It was just, again, it was the flash versus the, I don't even know what the word I'm looking for is, but he just couldn't build the not sexy positions.
Right. Yeah. A little more sizzle than steak or something.
There you go.
But yeah, I mean like honestly, cause you know, guys like Odell and Landon Collins and really, you know, pretty much all the wide receivers he used high picks on, they were, you know, Pucky Nicks and he brought in talent. But listen, like I said, I'm not trying to rewrite history. There was a ton of misses, and he totally deserved to get fired. But I think he deserved another shot. I mean, listen, if I was another fan base, knowing everything we know, I'm not saying I'd be over the moon if my franchise hired him. You know, you probably maybe like to find a young up and comer or someone who hasn't gotten that shot. But I just think it's kind of bizarre how Giants fan act like he was the worst thing that ever happened. I mean, he did play a pretty big role in you know getting two Super Bowls as this franchise. Yep. I know everyone likes to say it was of course his team, but he was integral in those drafts. And then the 11 team, if you just go back and look at that roster, there was a lot of guys who came in well after Ernie Accorsi had left the building. So, you know, that's my mini rant where I just like, I've become a Jerry Reese advocate, like totally unwillingly. Cause it's not a guy that I'm like going to bat for. Cause we're just, you know, we're so tight and we're always texting or anything like that. I just think he gets a raw deal in sort of the Giants history books. The fact that like people don't think he should be in the Ring of Honor to me, you know, blows my mind. But yeah,
it is absolute. It's bullshit. The fact that people will not like clap for this dude for him to get in the Ring of Honor. I mean, that's just horrible.
It's horrible. I don't get it.
But we're gonna run circles for Dave Gettleman. Yeah. I'm not gonna rant. I know.
This one's from Billy. Biggest positive and negative from this season. I can start on this one just because I think it's pretty obvious answer. Biggest positive, Joe Judge seems like the real deal. The Giants have their head coach. Biggest negative for me is that Dan Jones has not improved. And I don't see how that can be how that cannot be the biggest negative, because now we have questions going into the offseason about what the Giants should do at the quarterback position.
Yeah, no, you can't argue that negative point at all. And again, even if you're like, I was kind of bullish on Daniel Jones coming into this season, so I'm not trying to like jump ship, but it's just I haven't seen anything that kind of like makes me believe that he's gonna just all of a sudden put it all together. Like, I'm not saying it won't happen. You see Ryan Tannehill, it can happen at different times for different guys, but man, you didn't see anything this year to make you believe that he's any closer to being a franchise quarterback. So that's tough to come out of this year like with that feeling. Yeah, Judge definitely, you know, I've touched on that. Definitely, he's a big positive. You can certainly go to Patrick Graham, because I was super skeptical of like the whole circumstance of him coming here. Like, Brian Flores apparently is just that good of a guy and let his buddy, you know, come closer to home. And I thought the defense wasn't going to be very good, you know, and you know, the talent is still a little spotty, but the way he's been able to just kind of scheme around it and just come up with these game plans, you know, pretty much week after week, you know, been a little spotty these last two games, but still they're not getting lit up by any stretch. I think he's been a great find. I know you've been really funny on trying not to get him hired as a head coach. I'd be surprised.
It's all a shtick. I'm not worried about it.
Yeah. Like there's going to be better candidates than a guy who's, you know, been the defensive coordinator for 2 years and both teams went, you know, 5-11 or 6-10, wherever it might end up being. And, you know, he's going to get his name out there, which is great for him. And I'm sure if he interviews well and gets on the circuit, you know, maybe in a year or two, or maybe just kills an interview this year and then he's gone. But I would highly expect him to be back. And that's good because, I mean, he's done a really good job. And I think you have to have confidence that another year in this system with him and filling in some of the holes that, you know, we touched on that they have should be only even be better next year.
Yep. Yeah. This is from Mike. I haven't done too much draft research on the wide receivers outside of the two obvious ones, Devontae Smith and Ja'Marr Chase. But who are your favorite wide receivers in the draft?
Yeah, no, I mean, we were talking before we started recording. I don't watch college football, basically, which is like people are going to be like, oh, I can't believe that. But I mean, there's only so many hours of football I'm allowed to watch as a married father of a toddler. So Thursday night, all day Sunday, Monday night, I can't do that. I'd be divorced if I was trying to watch every college football game on Saturday. So, I mean, listen, I see the highlights. I know what's going on, but I'm not, I mean, once, you know, there's plenty, I always say that people are always asking questions about the draft in like October, November, and hey, that's great. That's why people like Mel Kiper have, you know, probably very nice houses. But there's so much going on for me right now, just trying to keep up with the Giants, that there's, you know, 4 months after the season, I'll dive in then. I still never act like I'm, you know, baldy breaking down film of prospects or anything like that. But I'll have a much better sense from talking to people, you know, I don't know what the heck's happening with the combine this year. But that's where I usually kind of, base my analysis. It's not based on me sitting there like, oh, I really like the way this guy, you know, gets in and out of his routes. I just talk to people who know a lot more about it than me, because again, it's just only so many hours, and I do live and breathe this Giants team, which makes you reconsider life choices sometimes. But so I don't have time to also, you know, live and breathe the college game.
All right, this is from Shane. Any potential GM candidates?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly something I'll have to really you know, kind of dive into as I'm sitting here. It's like, crap, I gotta get going on some of these story ideas. I think the name that gets thrown out a lot is Monty Austinfort, I believe that's how you pronounce it, who's a guy. I mean, what you're going to do is, let's be honest, we're all going to just look at guys with New England ties, because Judge has very clearly leaned on guys, you know, who he had past relationships with when he was filling out his staff. So, you know, it makes sense that he's going to lean that way if they do, you know, go outside the building for a GM. You know, Austin Fort's a guy who's sort of been on the rise, was thought highly of by the Patriots. He's in Tennessee now. I think his title is director of player personnel. So GM would be, you know, the next step up for him. And, you know, I don't think the Titans GM's going anywhere. So I could see that. You know, again, I don't want to just like throw names off the top of my head. He's the lead candidate in terms of just what, you know, the connecting dots and stuff like that. But, and I do think, like, if they were to move on from Gettleman and bring a GM in, like I would have to assume Joe Judge is going to have a heavy influence in whoever they bring in. Yeah. Like, I think it's crazy that there's this idea, even actually the whole idea last year, where like, oh, you have to, you know, you can't fire the coach and not the GM. But like, I mean, why? You have to hire one before the other. Like, they're not literally going to get like a package deal. So you kept Gettleman. You can think that was a bad decision on merit, but okay. So you fire him this year and you bring in a guy who works with Judge. If you fired Gettleman last year, you would have hired another GM who would then have to work. Like they still have to be compatible. It doesn't really matter what order they come in, at least to me. I think it's just an accepted truth. I don't get why it matters which order they're hired. I mean, honestly, I think I'd rather the head coach be the guy who's really setting the direction for my franchise. Because, I mean,
I would agree.
I almost think the GM's almost more of a complimentary role. I mean, I think the Giants see them as sort of separate but equal and working together, and then that's fine. But if, like, in a tie, I want the coach to have the final say, not the GM. So I mean, it totally makes sense. I think there's been plenty of examples of power structures where the coach has more more power, and it certainly worked out in New England and Seattle and New Orleans. I mean, just go on and on. There's plenty of circumstances where the head coach is the number one guy, and so if they're going to hire a new GM, I would certainly want to be someone who Joe Judge signs off of and, you know, believe they're going to have the same vision and work well together.
Yeah.
One name I'm not trying to play insider, but one name that just keeps is still floating around is Lou Riddick. Giants ownership really still likes Lou Riddick. And there's no direct connection between Judge and Lou Riddick, but Riddick has ties to Nick Saban and has a relationship with Belichick. So that's just a name I've quote unquote heard, still liked, but not my top choice, but I'm just going to throw it out there, Dan. And maybe you can look
at it. I mean, obviously it makes sense. He interviewed it. It wouldn't necessarily excite me. He's reached like mythical levels of like every team should hire him as GM. Cause like he speaks well on TV. Like, I know he has some background, but it's been a while since he's been in the front office. Like, how do we know that he would be a good GM? And I know that people who don't like him are quick to point out that he was like the biggest Dwayne Haskins fan. And, you know, but again, guys get picked wrong, guys get takes wrong. So I can't hold something like that against him. But it's just like, it's strange that there's such a large segment of not just the Giants fan base, just like the NFL fan base who's convinced he'd be a good GM because he's articulate on ESPN. Like, there's like obviously a lot more that goes into the job. And he's not unimpressive to me. I just don't understand why so many people think like, oh, it's a no brainer. If you can get Lewis Riddick. Like, I mean, I don't know. He's interviewed for a lot of jobs, hasn't gotten him. So that kind of says something too, I think. But I mean, listen, if Joe Judge signs off on Riddick, then so be it. I mean, I think you have to really just throw all your eggs in the Joe Judge basket. And if we're all wrong in our gut feelings on him and it blows up spectacularly, then obviously you're starting over. But so, yeah, I think it has to come down to whoever Judge is most comfortable with if they end up going that route.
Two names that I've been throwing around, Ed Dodds and the lesser known Mike Borgonzi from Kansas City. Right now, what's his exact title? I think he's director of football operations or something like that. He's been there like 10 years. They've drafted incredibly well. They understand the process of the modern NFL. So I'd be a fan of either of those two. And he seems to be an under the radar name that if not this year, he'll start popping up in the next few years as a potential GM candidate. I'm not going to read this question, but it involves a certain SNY beat reporter. Okay, this is from Dino. Who the hell voted Evan Engram into the Pro Bowl? All right. So that's more of a rhetorical question. I'm like flabbergasted by that. I understand that the options were not like that great. And part of the voting is peer voting. And I'm sure that there are some defenders and players out there who respect his speed and what he can do when he's not fucking up. But I mean, Logan Thomas, I would even still take Evan Engram over like Robert Tonyan, but like, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the funny part is you talk about the voting. It's, you know, it's a third, a third, a third, fans, yeah, players and coaches. And he was fourth among fans. So it's not this shouldn't actually be a surprise to people who are really, live and breathe the Giants. It wasn't as if the Giants fan base was stuffing the balance for him, because he's probably the most polarizing player in the roster. So it's not some situation where the fan base just all rallied behind Evan Engram and made sure he got to the Pro Bowl. I mean, no, he was fourth. So it was the coaches and the players, you know, pushed him over the edge. I think, you know, definitely the fact that Kittle and Ertz were hurt, you know, those are kind of perennial Pro Bowlers, not a very strong crop. From a first round pick, so name recognition, because listen, I have to talk to some players. I miss being in the locker room so much. You can ask these types of questions, like, and get a quick answer. It's a lot harder this year with everything being on Zoom and just hoping I got to text you back or whatnot. But I don't think they put a ton of thought into their Pro Bowl ballots. I'll say that. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's left on their stool, and a lot of them probably get crumpled up. A lot of them just boom, boom, boom. Like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how they can enforce, you know, you have to fill it out and you have to put any thought into it. You know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine that DeAndre Baker last year was pouring over like, oh, who's the best left tackle in the NFC, you know? So I think that, you know, guys just say, oh, Evan Engram, yeah, he's fast, or yeah, like, you know, you say, we saw him on a scouting report, or hey, we haven't even played the Giants, remember this guy, you know, he's a first round pick. So I don't even know who Robert Tonyan is if you haven't played the Packers. So I think that definitely, you know, and the coach, I mean, that means his secretary filled it out probably. So again, like, I think the voting process is definitely a little flawed, and that it worked in Engram's favor. And then the final irony is, though, you know, I mentioned Kittle and Ertz not making it because they were hurt. Evan Engram suited up 15 games, 14 games, assuming he suits up on Sunday. That durability is what's going to get him over the top, getting that Pro Bowl nod. So it's kind of funny how that sort of went full circle.
Evan Engram will be a great tight end in this league. I truly believe that.
Well, we all can hope. This is from Parker. This is actually a good one because we haven't really discussed this one yet. What does the future outlook of Saquon with the Giants look like?
Oof, that's probably
a good question, given the Ezekiel Elliott rumors that were flying around today.
Yeah, and a good question that you could probably spend 45 minutes on some point this offseason, because there's so many, you know, we talk about Daniel Jones, but, you know, what's what's the front office shakeup going to be like? I mean, I think it's not a good thing that he tore his ACL, but the only thing is, if he had a good year this year, he was going to get a monster extension this offseason. There was no doubt about it. Like, I don't care if get him those hair or not. Like, they would have given him a big extension. The fact that, you know, he has this injury, it's going to force them to take a step back. Obviously, you hope he has a monster four season and comes back and has Adrian Peterson MVP season off ACL. We don't know that he will, but at least there'll be like two injuries on the resume where if you're someone who doesn't believe in investing heavily in a second contract for running back, it gives you some pause and it gives you some debate, and it's not an automatic just sign the check and regret the $100 million in like a year. I'm not trying to say the injury is good or a blessing in disguise. I just think if you don't want to invest that much in running back, because time after time it's proven to be a bad investment, it might have saved them some themselves a little bit. Because there's no way, I shouldn't say never, especially if Edelman's back. There's no way they do an extension within this offseason. I mean, I think he'd be crazy too, because his value is going to be at an all-time low. If he comes back and has a monster season next year, he's going to be right back in the Christian McCaffrey stratosphere. But I mean, right now, I can't imagine he'd get that again. You know, have to put the addendum in. I don't know that, you know, if Edelman's here, maybe he would, but I really doubt it. I think that you have to see who the GM is. You have to see how he plays next year. And then you kind of circle back next offseason. I think obviously we're all in agreement that, you know, giving a $90 million extension to a running back is not good business. You would like to think that Joe Judge and whoever is the GM at that point shares that thought, but it's hard to say with this organization.
Fair enough. I got one more from Jeff. Would you rather sign a free agent wide receiver or draft one in round one or two?
Yeah, that's a good question. And when you look at it, there's going to be a lot of top free agent wide receivers this year. So I'm probably more inclined to, you know, dip the toe in the water there. I mean, nothing to say you can't do both.
I think you have to do both.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously free agency comes first. So, I mean, you don't know, is Kenny Golladay in your franchise tag, this or that. But there's a lot of, you know, quality guys and really top end guys that are still – in their prime. You know, you're not talking about guys, you know, on the wrong side of 30, you're talking 26, 27, 28, that it's, you know, it's a worthy investment, a 3-4 year, you know, big money deal. Because they just need to upgrade that position. So if you sign Allen Robinson and you sign Kenny Golladay, then you go into the draft with your first round pick, you can, you know, take the, you know, best player available, the, you know, the line every GM likes to say. But then if you're sitting there in the second round and the next Chase Claypool or the, you know, the next guy like that's available, there's nothing stopping it from doubling up. I don't know that I want to just sit out free agency with so many top options and then just say they're picking ninth, say, okay, well, we have to, you know, maybe force a wide receiver here. I think they just need to address that position. Obviously, you have a lot more control over the variables in free agency. They're going to have some money. So I think that's the way I would go. But like I said, I wouldn't rule out, you know, coming back on day two if you sign, you know, a stud receiver free agency. I still think you could, you know, couldn't hurt to add another one if there's someone available.
Fair enough. I think that's it for me.
Is it?
We've taken up a good chunk of Dan's time. Weiss, anything else?
We're overtime right now. So.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get him back to dad duty. All right. I think that's it. We'll wrap it up. We'll take care of the housekeeping one more time. Follow us on Twitter. Follow me at EthanGSN, Weiss, NYG Daily, the blog, GothamSN. Follow Dan D. Duggan 21 on Twitter. Subscribe to The Athletic. Read his stuff. It's real good. Dan, thanks for coming on. And we'll have you back probably in the off season. And we'll talk to everyone else next week.
Peace.